All right. It is exactly 5 o'clock, and so we're going to get this meeting started. So welcome to our Public Safety Committee meeting for Monday, March 16th. And this meeting, it's going to be a little different than our traditional committee meetings because I wanted to accommodate the public in two ways. The first way that I wanted to accommodate the public as chair is that many of you requested that this meeting be later in the day. So that way you can attend and not have to worry about work conflicts. And so we changed the meeting time from 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock to meet that that request. The second request that I had is that the public comment not be just a typical public comment where you say your statement and then no one responds. We decided to change it this time and allow for a public comment where you can ask a question, and we will allow for responses from the sheriff or for committee members or for the county administrator as you address it. Now, so that is a change, and that's going to actually occur after the presentation. So that way you can listen to the presentation, see if it covered your questions, and if it did not, you can ask you the questions that you might have. Now, we have two challenges, though, with our time frame. We're going to start this presentation pretty quickly, but I have two resolutions that I do need to get done today as well, and both of them are because they require us pushing the state legislature and the governor before this budget is done. And those two issues are that we have a resolution on solitary confinement and to reform solitary confinement, and so that it's not as punitive and onerous, destructive, I would say, as it is right now. And then the other resolution that we have is on juvenile justice reform. And what we're trying to do is urge the governor to, or agree with the governor and urge the state legislature to take action to move the age that a juvenile is considered an adult to 18. Currently, it's 16 years old. And so we want to push the governor to do that, but we also want the governor to acknowledge that there are costs that are associated with this, and we would like them to cover it. So in order to pass those two resolutions that I'm sure that many of you feel passionately about, we have to keep this meeting pretty tight. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the sheriff and undersheriff to do their presentation in about 50 minutes or so. And if it takes a little more time, that's all right, up to an hour. But then we're going to have Q&A for about half an hour. Half an hour at the most. And so I know you do have statements, but I would try to change your statements to questions so that way we can get them addressed and we can accommodate as many people as possible, because I know there's many of you that have questions. Is that clear for committee members? Good? All right. So I am going to skip the chair's report. Yes, Martha.
Since other legislators are here, you might remind the public who's actually on public safety this year.
Yes, the actual public safety committee members, there's five of us, are me, Nate Shinagawa, I'm the chair. Then also we have Jim Dennis, the vice chair. We have Martha Robertson, Will Burbank, and Carol Chalk. And we're joined by Dooley Kiefer, who represents the Cayuga Heights area. And Dan Klein is also in the audience. And Dan, you're welcome to come up here too if you wish. All right. And then also we're joined by many others as well. And we can actually probably do those introductions. If the sheriff, if you can introduce the folks that you're with, I think that would be helpful. And then also we have Joe Mariana, our county administrator, who's here as well. Joe, you have copies of this after action report. Did you want to distribute that now?
I have about 20 copies.
Okay, all right. So the sheriff has prepared a 34-page document that is just it's the report, but backing up the report is this binder, which we do not have copies for of you. But at least you can look at those 34 pages. There are 20 copies that are available. And so with that, I'm going to turn this over to Sheriff Lansing. For the after-action report regarding 127 Hornbrook Road.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to welcome everybody here tonight. I truly hope that this presentation that we have put together will answer a lot of the questions that have been out there by the community. The work done in this was done not solely by me, that is for sure. The undersheriff, Brian Robinson, put a lot of this report together. What we have here tonight to assist us with this presentation is the Undersheriff, Brian Robinson, also Lieutenant Jacob Young, and also Senior Investigator Mike Gray. They were all people that were a part of this operation for those days that it took place here in the town of Danby. Hopefully, when we're done, the questions that you might have that aren't answered from this report, we'll be able to give you those answers at the time that'll be allotted. So with that being said, I'd like to turn over the beginning of this report to the Undersheriff, Brian Robinson.
Thanks, Sheriff. And just so everyone's aware, I believe, and I don't know if Marcia's here. Marcia, has that been, is this report now on the web? Okay. All right. So if you don't get a copy of it, you can certainly find it there as well. Oh, I thought you were waving to me. So that we don't miss anything, we're actually going to read the entire report as we sit here. So it begins with an executive summary. On Tuesday, December 30th, 2014, at approximately 7:55 p.m., two uniformed members of the Tompkins County Sheriff's Office went to the home of David Cady, located at 127 Hornbrook Road in the town of Danby, for the purpose of taking Mr. Cady into custody under a bench warrant issued by County Court Judge John Rowley. The warrant resulted from Mr. Cady's failure to comply with conditions set by felony drug court after his second felony DWI conviction. The Sheriff's Office and New York State Police had attempted to serve the warrant on Mr. Cady on at least 12 previous occasions. While initially advising officers that Mr. Cady was not at home, his wife, Melissa Cady, confirmed his presence and indicated that he had a loaded gun. This high-risk situation, later borne out by a shot fired from the second floor window by Mr. Cady in the vicinity of officers, led to a prolonged two-and-a-half-day standoff that was shaped by a number of factors ranging from bitterly cold weather to the particularly lethal type of weapon that Mr. Cady's possession, to lessons learned in other barricading events that ended in deadly gunfire. As will be described in this report, a progression of non-lethal tactics was used to draw Mr. Cady, out of the house throughout the incident. Negotiations conducted by trained personnel seemed promising, but ultimately failed when Mr. Cady stopped responding to calls early in the first day of the standoff. In his final contact with the negotiating team, Mr. Cady said, "I'm armed up, come get me." Small robots were deployed to serve as eyes and ears of law enforcement, but could not reach all parts of the house. Tear gas, noise flash devices, and loud hails were used to increase the pressure on Mr. Cady to exit the home. Ultimately, as a way to expose and draw Mr. Cady, heavy equipment was used to open up parts of the house. Simply put, a choice was made that placed the lives of Mr. Cady and law enforcement officers over property. As is now known, Mr. Cady died of a self-inflicted gunshot before officers entered the home at about 8:30 a.m. on January 2nd. In the subsequent inspection of the Cady home, a total of 6 long guns were found positioned in several rooms throughout the house. 2 remained behind a wall panel that had been peeled away, leaving the weapons accessible to Mr. Cady. It was clear that Mr. Cady had spent much time positioned at the top of a narrow stairway leading to the second floor, armed with 2 guns and with a clear line of sight to whomever approached. This textbook, Fatal Funnel, strongly affirmed the cautious strategy followed by law enforcement, including the decision not to enter the house earlier in the event. This report attempts to describe the incident and the response by law enforcement answer questions that have been raised, and consider how elements of response to this incident can inform strategies and tactics in future situations. By way of history, Mr. Cady was 37 years old, lived in and around the Tompkins County area for approximately 15 years. Appears to have been born and raised in the state of Pennsylvania. Mr. Cady's criminal record included a 60-day jail sentence in Allegheny County, resulting from an arrest in 1998, and three arrests for driving while intoxicated between 2004 and 2013. The last two DWI felony charges that occurred in Tompkins County. The initial Tompkins County felony DWI arrest occurred in June of 2008 and resulted in a sentence of 5 years probation and a $1,000 fine. His subsequent felony DWI arrest in 2013 violated the terms of his 2008 probation, causing him to be remanded in Tompkins County Jail for a brief period in November through December of 2013. Following his release, Mr. Cady was ordered to attend felony drug court under the supervision of the County Probation Department. Mr. Cady violated the conditions of drug court and was sanctioned to serve a 25-day jail sentence, for which he served 4 weekends in county jail. A subsequent violation of the felony drug court conditions resulted in an additional 10-day sentence in May of 2014. Thereafter, Mr. Cady was ordered to attend and or abide by the conditions of felony drug court. Despite that order, Mr. Cady stopped attending altogether by the summer of 2014, causing Judge John Rowley to issue a bench warrant for Mr. Cady on August 26, 2014. The warrant directed law enforcement to take Mr. Cady into custody and bring him before the court. In compliance with Judge Rowley's order, at least 12 documented attempts were made by law enforcement personnel from either the Tompkins County Sheriff's Office and or the New York State Police to serve the warrant upon Mr. Cady. Documents show that Melissa Cady, David's wife, reported on one occasion in November of 2014 that Cady was not present in the home but was at work at Wilcox Tire in Ithaca. When checked, the employer stated that Mr. Cady had not worked there for months. A month later, Ms. Cady told law enforcement officers that Mr. Cady had moved to Oklahoma and that she had not had contact with him for months. However, sources advised law enforcement that Mr. Cady was continuing to live at the Hornbrook Road address. These facts led to additional attempts to enforce the warrant and take Mr. Cady into custody, including the evening of December 30th, 2014. The initial response on December 30th, 2014, at about 7:55 p.m., Sheriff's Office personnel attempted to serve the arrest warrant on David Cady at his home at 127 Hornbrook Road in Danby. Sergeant James Vann and Deputy Matt Hasselman met just east of the house and agreed that they would go to the house and would try to determine if Cady was present inside the residence before knocking on the door. The deputies heard voices of an adult male, an adult female, and 2 children inside the residence. Sergeant Vann also saw David Cady for a brief moment inside the house and recognized him from a photograph he had reviewed just prior to arrival. Now knowing that Cady was in fact present at the location, the 2 deputies split off to be able to view all sides of the residence in the event Cady attempted to flee the residence. Sergeant Vann then knocked on the same door he and Deputy Hazelman had been standing at, which was at the southeast corner of the residence that was believed to be the kitchen area. Vann said that he heard a male and a female speaking softly to one another, and that after about 3 minutes, the door was opened by a young man later identified as one of the sons, Matthew. Sergeant Vann advised Matthew he needed to speak with David. To which the youngster replied, "My brother." Matthew yelled for David, and Van was then speaking with both children, Matthew and David the third. Sergeant Van then asked to speak with an adult. After approximately another 3 minutes, an adult female, later identified as Melissa Cady, came to the door. Van advised Ms. Cady that he needed to speak with David and that David needed to take care of the warrants that had been issued for him. Ms. Cady denied that David was present at the residence and said she had not heard from him in some time. Sergeant Van then informed Melissa that he had both seen and heard David inside the residence and further advised her of the law as it pertains to executing a warrant at the subject's primary residence. Van allowed Ms. Cady a moment inside to speak with David Cady. She returned to the door, again stating he was not at home, and she was also on the phone stating she was calling her attorney. Van advised Ms. Cady that the attorney would likely encourage her to cooperate with the police so that she herself would not get into trouble. Sergeant Van then let Ms. Cady go back inside and asked that she encourage David to come out and comply with the court order. After about 5 minutes went by with no contact with anyone inside the house, Sergeant Van radioed a request for additional units to head to his direction or his location. Sergeant Van again knocked on the door. After an additional two minutes, Ms. Cady returned to the door. Van said that Ms. Cady appeared to be more shaken by this situation and that she displayed with her right hand the universal sign for a gun. Ms. Cady told Van that David now had a gun and was not going to cooperate. Sergeant Van then ordered her to get the children and get out of the house. She refused and retreated back into the house. At that point, Sergeant Van felt he was in a vulnerable position and retreated back to a covered position in a barn located to the east of the residence. Over the next 30 minutes or so, as supporting units arrived on the scene, Sergeant Van established perimeter coverage of the residence. Van further advised all personnel that Mr. Cady reportedly had a gun, and he ordered radio protocols for an emergency situation. He also made the initial request for the combined IPD Tompkins County Sheriff's Office SWAT team to respond for what had developed into a barricaded person's situation. In accordance with policy, Van also made notification to Under Sheriff Osborne of the situation for initial incident command. SWAT call out was made at 8:29 p.m. for all SWAT personnel, including critical incident negotiation teams or SINT members, to report directly to the scene. Sergeant Van also continued communications via telephone with Ms. Cady in an effort to get her and the children out of the residence. At approximately 9:27 p.m., Ithaca PD Sergeant, now Lieutenant, Jacob Young, SWAT commander or SWAT team commander, arrived at scene, and all further incident command occurred from the incident command center that was located in the parking area near the buildings east of 127 Hornbrook Road. Scene security. By policy, Sheriff's Office Sergeant Van was responsible for initially securing the scene in and around the 127 Hornbrook Road at the beginning of the standoff. As officers arrived on scene, they were instructed to get to an assigned side of the residence so that all sides could be viewed and to take cover suitable against what was eventually reported to be a 30-30 rifle. Standard bulletproof vests and patrol vehicles do not provide adequate cover for such weaponry. Additionally, both ends of Hornbrook Road needed to be blocked off from all but emergency traffic. New York State Police uniformed troopers were detailed by their supervisors to block Hornbrook Road at the Marsh Road and Route 96B intersections for the duration of the operation. No one, including neighbors, media, and other non-law enforcement related personnel, was allowed near the Cady residence for their own safety. Unfortunately, this order also included operations at the Town of Danby Highway Department, which is accessed by a driveway located to the west of Katie's residence. Mutual aid. The goal of the response to the Hornbrook Roads barricading incident was simple and straightforward: to achieve a peaceful surrender by Mr. Cady, to ensure that he could not escape from the scene and possibly cause injury or death to others, and to protect the health and safety of the officers involved. Although simple, these goals could not be accomplished solely by the resources available locally. For example, to protect officers from the body armor-piercing bullets of a 30-30 rifle and to shelter them from below-zero weather, armored personnel vehicles were needed. Neither the City of Ithaca nor the Tompkins County Sheriff's Office possessed this type of vehicle. To ensure that swift transportation to the hospital was available if shots were fired at this remote location, a helicopter close to the site was an appropriate safety feature. To avoid a violent confrontation inside the house, reconnaissance by robot devices was preferable to sending in officers. Only one is owned by local law enforcement. Additionally, around-the-clock coverage of the incident required multiple shifts, placing a burden on local personnel resources. To augment the limited number of personnel available to staff the response, personnel support was needed from the New York State Police and, by longstanding agreement, the Elmira Police Department. To assist with personnel and equipment, the following agencies were involved: Onondaga County Sheriff's Office provided its armored personnel carrier and two operators. Syracuse Police Department provided its armored personnel carrier and two operators, as well as a throw phone. Broome County Sheriff's Office provided its armored personnel carrier and two operators. The Elmira Police Department, as part of a longstanding mutual aid agreement, provided SWAT team members to augment and relieve the combined IPD Sheriff's Office team, also made available a small reconnaissance robot. Cornell Police and Ithaca College both have members on the SINT, or negotiating team. New York State Police deployed a SORT, a Special Operations and Response Team unit, to augment and relieve the local team, provide road access control, and also made three reconnaissance robots available. The Pennsylvania State Police provided heavy equipment, their Rook and operator. Several agencies provided tear gas canisters. The Guthrie Trauma Center positioned a medical helicopter, transport helicopter, and crew on site. Bangs Ambulance positioned an ambulance and crew on site. Tompkins County Mental Health Department provided personnel as part of its involvement with the SINT team to assist in negotiations. The mutual aid agreement allowed two armored personnel carriers to be positioned in location that would provide a 360-degree vantage point for officers in the vehicles, and a third APC to use for positioning reconnaissance robots, throw phones, and other such equipment. By having the APCs available to maintain surveillance of the home without subjecting officers to the frigid cold, it also reduced the need for deploying additional officers simply for the purpose of spelling officers who would need frequent relief from the elements. Mutual aid from surrounding agencies provided an invaluable amount of resources that helped keep officers safe and added to the opportunity to end the incident safely.
Brian, or Under Sheriff Robinson, we are at 5:25 right now, and so I think we can keep on going with this presentation until 6, and I will still allow 30 minutes of Q&A. But based on your rate right now, you may want to find pieces that that you can omit or speed it up.
Okay. Well, Jake's going to take over for this section.
Okay.
He might be quicker.
Yeah, talk faster. I'll find out. So most of this SWAT operations that I'm going to read was written by me. However, we've interjected some of the New York State Police notes in here. And if you have a copy of it, you'll see that they're indented and italicized. The following statement is an overview of tactical operations that occurred during the 127 Hornbrook Road armed barricade incident, which began on December 30th, 2014, and ended on January 2nd of 2015. It's important to note that there were a number of moving parts happening simultaneously during the incident, and times noted should be considered accurate but approximate in nature, as each scribe recording the information may have recorded it at a slightly different or delayed time. The purpose of this report is to look is to include and look at the SWAT operations that occurred. However, some details of tactics used are left intentionally generic so as not to diminish the effectiveness in future operations. Quick background, the Ithaca Police SWAT team is a tactical team that's comprised of IPD and Tompkins County Sheriff deputies. It's a multi-jurisdictional shared resources team that serves all of Tompkins County, New York. The SWAT team was formed in 1998 after the on-duty death of Ithaca Police Investigator Michael Padula in 1996. Investigator Padula was on the scene of a female that was barricaded in an apartment with a knife. Investigator Padula was fatally stabbed in the neck by the barricaded female, and he died at the scene of the call while trying to negotiate with the woman. After this incident, it became clear that there was a need for a specialized tactical unit and a negotiator unit to safely work similar incidents in the future. The Ithaca Police SWAT team is a highly trained tactical unit, which currently includes a total of 16 officers. All 16 SWAT officers are certified through the New York State Department of Criminal Justice Services as SWAT operators and have each attended all training required to operate in that capacity. Furthermore, the Ithaca SWAT team also meets and exceeds regular monthly training standards, policy standards, and best practices set forth by DCGS to operate a tactical team within the state of New York. Ithaca Police SWAT has a mutual aid agreement with Elmira City SWAT. This mutual aid agreement is, like the undersheriff said, longstanding and is used if either team has an extended operation or a large-scale operation in which they need more personnel. Ithaca Police SWAT also maintains a close working relationship with several other tactical teams in our region. These other teams in our region can be called upon, as they were in this incident, to assist with additional resources such as armor personnel carriers, robots, gear, and other tools that may be of use in any given operation. The command structure of the Ithaca Police SWAT team consists of a commander, assistant commander, and two team leaders and assistant team leaders. Supervision of tactical officers consists of a very small span of control due to the type of work, which is often technical and dangerous in nature. The tactical commander at an incident would be in charge of the SWAT team members, just as the negotiations team commander is in charge of negotiation members. The SWAT commander then reports to the incident commander and makes recommendations in regards to tactics. The SINT team that we've already spoken about is also a multi-jurisdictional team of highly trained negotiators and mental health professionals from across Tompkins County. The SINT commander is Sergeant Deb Lawrence of the Ithaca Police Department, and negotiators on the team include IPD, Tompkins County Sheriff's Office, Cornell, Ithaca College, and Tompkins County Mental Health. The SINT team works and trains hand-in-hand with the SWAT team to work towards a safe resolution on call-outs such as barricaded incidents. The narrative below begins on December 30th, 8:24 p.m. The initial contact and incident actually began at 7:46, as already noted. I'm going to omit the next paragraph, which is already what we went over. Okay, so I'm just going to omit since we're short on time. It's all been already stated. SWAT Commander Sergeant Young was en route to the scene and obtained the above intelligence via phone calls and radio traffic. Sergeant Young also put Elmira PD SWAT on standby at 9:22 due to the cold weather and nature of the incident, though the official request for their assistance was not completed until approximately 10 p.m. by Ithaca Police Deputy Chief Pete Tyler. Sergeant Young arrived at the Danby Firehouse, which was the initial staging area, at 9:22 p.m., just behind our mobile command truck. A minute or so prior to this, everyone was advised by on-scene deputies that the female and teenagers were out of the house and in the safe custody of a deputy. This left only Mr. Cady in the residence. It was determined that the best place for the command post would be the old salvage yard located next door to 127 Hornbrook. The command truck was moved to this location, which provided a safe location that was nearby the scene of the incident. After receiving all intelligence updates, such as many of the items listed previously in the narrative, it was determined that Mr. Cady would be considered an armed barricade individual, and the situation, tactics, and negotiations used would be barricade resolution-based. See below definition. We give you the definition of a barricaded subject. Any person who's demonstrated a capability and or stated the intent to cause death or serious physical injury to a person, including himself, who has achieved a tactical advantage by the use of a physical obstruction, could be a building, room, vehicle, or any other natural or man-made barrier, and refuses to comply with demands from police to surrender. IPD investigator Mike Gray, a team leader for a negotiations team, was now on scene and starting initial negotiations with Mr. Cady. Investigator Gray was advised that SINC Commander Sergeant Lawrence was not available, so he would be acting as SINC Commander for the incident. Investigator Gray had already started some initial dialogue with Mr. Cady. However, he was positioned back at the command post to coordinate negotiation efforts, which he did. Undersheriff Osborne was now on scene and was acting as the incident commander. The undersheriff was brought up to speed by myself on the tactical resources available and en route. The first tactical plan was to get in place two reactionary teams to be able to safely deal with Mr. Cady when he decided to come out of the residence. The next plan was to replace the patrol units on the perimeter as more SWAT officers arrived. It should be noted that it was bitterly cold outside with a temperature of about 15 degrees Fahrenheit and a wind chill of 6 degrees. The SINT and SWAT teams were both mobilizing at this point and both had officers arriving on scene and assisting with different tasks as needed. The first reactionary slash arrest team was sent out into a position at about 9:44 p.m. As more officers arrived, a second arrest team was sent out and a sniper observer team was also sent out for purposes of scouting the location and gaining intelligence. At about 10:32 p.m., the Tactical Operations Center, referred to in here as the TOC, received information from units attempting to maintain perimeter security that they needed additional light on side two, which if you're facing the residence would be the left side of the residence. For purposes of this report, the house at 127 Hornbrook will be labeled 1 through 4, with side one being the front side facing Hornbrook Road, and then each side numbered in order clockwise around the location. Corners would be described as a combination of the two sides that adjoin the corner. For example, corner where side one and two meet would be described as a 1-2 corner. Units that were requesting lights on side two of the structure suggested putting out a Pelican light, which is a portable battery-operated light. I advised them to hold off on this and worked on developing a resource that would offer a larger amount of light for a longer period of time and an option that provided a little more protection for officers that needed to deploy the light. This deploying the Pelican light would require an officer to walk out into an open area to place the light, and the light source would only last about 45 minutes in the cold. A plan to use spotlights on a New York State police vehicle was deployed due to the fact that their patrol cars offer two spotlights, where other agency cars only offered one. This would allow us to simultaneously direct two separate lights on side two of the house. The New York State police car would not provide full ballistic protection, but it would provide some protection and concealment for the officers that deployed the lights. Two SWAT operators were assigned to deployment of the New York State police vehicle and the placement of the lights onto the structure. The plan was to move the State Police Tahoe into place, turn on the spotlights, lock the vehicle, and leave it in place for the remainder of the incident. After officers completed the deployment, they would then quickly move back to a position of cover away from the Tahoe. At 11:16 p.m., both officers advised that they were en route to deploy the Tahoe. At 11:17 p.m., several reports were called in from units on the perimeter that at least one shot was fired out of the side two second floor window. The REACT arrest team, who was on the 2-3 corner, reported glass flying from a window on the second floor as the shot rang out. A status check of the two deputies on the deployment advised us that neither of them had been hit. One deputy reported seeing the round hit the snow about 20 feet from him and about 10 feet from the New York State Police Tahoe. All units were advised to recheck and evaluate their positions and attempt to find cover and or better concealment. At about 11:20 p.m., the SINT reported to the TAC that Mr. Cady was highly agitated and stated, quote, "If someone doesn't turn lights off, someone will get hurt," end quote. This was put out to all units and put us on high alert, as we believe that at any time Mr. Cady may attempt to shoot an officer due to the lights still being on the house. At this point, some mutual aid requests for armored personnel carriers were already being looked into. However, it was now clear due to the shot out of the window at police and the threats from Mr. Cady that we would need some APCs in order to keep officers on the perimeter safe. December 31st, 2014, the SINT team continues negotiations with Mr. Cady while SWAT team members continue to maintain a perimeter of the location and gain intelligence regarding Mr. Cady's whereabouts within the house. On 12:22 a.m., the final patrol unit is relieved from the perimeter location and SWAT officers are now fully deployed on the location. Elmira SWAT was also on scene and available to start rotating some of the officers out of the elements who had been out in the elements for over 2 hours. The temperature was now 8 degrees Fahrenheit. Over the next 2 hours, all SWAT operators were in the elements and needed to rotate frequently due to cold and wind. SINT continued to negotiate with Mr. Cady on and off, but no one on a perimeter was able to get a visual of his exact location as most of the house was dark on the inside. At around 2 o'clock a.m., the APCs from Regional Resources started arriving. This resource provided us the ability to have officers protected from the type of gunfire that we believe Mr. Cady had, provided warmth for officers, and provided extra lighting onto the residents to better see what was going on. Once the APCs started arriving, officers were assigned to them and tasked with a position to observe the house. Into the early morning hours of December 31st, negotiation efforts continued. Several times throughout these hours, it appeared that Mr. Cady may come out, but he never did. At one point, Mr. Cady stated that he would come out, and an agreement was worked out that he would not be proned out or made to lay in the snow when officers moved up to handcuff him. Mr. Cady was advised that we would allow this, and he stated he would unscrew the front door of the residence and come out. SWAT officers had a plan in place to meet Mr. Cady's needs, but this never happened, and Mr. Cady stayed in the residence. Negotiations with Mr. Cady continued up until about 4 o'clock a.m. One of the final communications from Mr. Cady was that he was armed up and to come get him. This was an indicator that Mr. Cady was intent on staying inside and an indicator that if we were to make entry into the residence, a gunfight would be likely to ensue. D.A. Wilkinson was also notified about the incident during this morning by Undersheriff Robinson, who was also now on scene. Once contact was lost with Mr. Cady and attempts to get him back on the phone were unsuccessful, further efforts were made to get Cady to come out of the residence. Several NFDs, noise flash devices, were deployed in strategic locations on the outside of the residence in an effort to get Mr. Cady to come out. The NFDs produced no result or movement from Mr. Cady. In a continued effort to get Mr. Cady to come out of the house, a set of 40-millimeter direct impact rounds were put into the location through pre-designated locations. These direct impact rounds were sent into the house using the same procedure.
We're obviously going to run out of time, so maybe for most of the remainder, we'll just hit the high spots that are on. I mean, folks can read this at any point, so.
Well, okay, all right, yeah. So that's fine. Undersheriff, you can use your judgment on how you want to proceed forward.
I'm being advised to do this, so okay. We can do this. That's fine.
I'm sorry, please do not ask questions to the committee. There will be a designated time for that.
Do you want to go ahead? We can go through these. These are yours, I believe, right?
Okay, we'll just hit the major milestones. Okay. So 7:55, we already did all that, so I guess we can move on. Robots. So 12:31, 4:43, tear gas deployment begins, and at 7:48, the first robot was inserted into the house. It's now daytime. Robots and cameras try to locate Cady. 5:20 p.m. on the 31st, Cady was seen in the house from outside carrying around a long gun. And between 5:27 and 5:47 p.m. on the 31st, Cady was seen three more times. 12:31, 8:09, the throw phone was inserted. And at 9:11, tear gas was employed. 9:13, 2 minutes later, coughing and walking was heard within the house through the throw phone. At 9:31, the tear gas continues, walking heard again. And at 11:30 p.m., we were able to turn the power to the residents off. On January 1st, early hours, tear gas was deployed into crawl space, throw phone inserted into the house. 7:52 a.m., coughing was heard again. 8 o'clock, discussion about entering the house and how that worked out in the Herkimer incident where a gunfight ensued was discussed. New York State Police suggested contacting PA State Police for their rook. January 1st, 8 to 10 a.m., tear gas deployed, coughing heard again. 9:53 a.m., Katie was seen, and this would be the state police would now be on scene at this point. These are their notes. Katie was seen blockading first floor window. At 1:40 p.m., the rook, as we discussed, arrives, and then the afternoon, the rook begins opening the structure up so we can see inside, or they could see inside at that point. 9:36 p.m., the rook ends operation for the night. 8 o'clock a.m., the rook operations resume, and shortly thereafter, Mr. Katie's body is discovered on the first floor.
Okay. I'm going to speak to the actions of the SINT team. I am not going to read from the report. I'm going to go a little bit off script here and tell you this. I was the first one to arrive that attempted to engage Mr. Katie in conversation beyond the initial responding deputies that went to the door and spoke only with his wife. I spoke with Mr. Cady via telephone from right outside of his house, explained to him who I was and why I was there, and without really being able to say more than a sentence or two, Mr. Cady began screaming at me, unintelligible things, accusing me of lying to him when I hadn't even said anything to him yet. He was clearly very agitated. After a few minutes of conversation, I was able to convince him that he needed to take a minute to compose himself and understand that I just wanted to have a conversation with him, and he agreed to take my call when I called him back in a few minutes. I did terminate the first call. I re-engaged him in conversation several minutes later, several being less than 10. Spoke to him again. He was much calmer. He asked some questions with regards to what was going to occur if he came out. I was very honest with him, told him at that point he had his warrants to answer to, and that was it. I did not try to tell him that you know, we could work it all out and he'd be able to stay home with his wife and kids, because that was not true. We were there to serve a warrant. We were there to take him into custody, and I made it very clear to him that that's what had to happen, that he needed to surrender himself so that he could be taken in front of a judge and answer the warrant that was issued. He seemed to understand that at the time. Prior to the termination of that phone call again, though, he became very agitated for no particular reason, and he terminated the call rather abruptly. This went on back and forth between he and I for quite a period of time. During my conversations with him, I transitioned myself from just outside the house to the command post, where we have better facilities for being able to hear the conversation, for being able to document it. Some of my additional negotiating personnel began arriving then to assist me with documenting the efforts and the responses that I was getting and information we needed in case this was a protracted situation. We spoke with him for several hours in several different forms. There was a period of time when I transitioned him to another investigator, another negotiator, who happened to be a female, and actually through conversation with Mrs. Cady, we learned that Mr. Cady may respond better to a female. So she began speaking with him and got a lot of the same results I did. Periods of calm along with periods of extreme agitation with no particular trigger that we could identify that would set him off on the higher ground, set him off on the agitation level that he had. The one thing that did occur several times was our request that Mr. Cady surrender himself, that he resolve the situation by coming out and facing the situation that he had. During the time that we were communicating with Mr. Cady, there was a shot fired, and that was after some lights were put in place. As the report states, He did fire a shot. He made some comments when he fired the shot, saying that he could have killed the officers, could have killed them, and made demands that we get that vehicle out of there and turn those lights off right away. Mr. Cady was afforded several opportunities to come out of the house. He was directed exactly what would happen if and when he did come out of the house with regards to officers approaching him and checking him to make sure he didn't have weapons for his safety as well as ours, and that they would take him into custody. He had concerns about being thrown face down in the snow or on the ground. I attempted to alleviate those concerns by telling him that when he came out, he needed to show his hands, and if he behaved like a gentleman, he would be treated like one. And that all he had to do was cooperate with the demands of the officers that would approach him. He was at times very receptive to my suggestions that he come out. There were times when other negotiators attempted to speak with him in which he agreed to come out. There were several times when he said, okay, I'm putting stuff down, I'm unlocking doors, I'm turning on lights, I'm coming out, and I would relay this stuff to the tactical people so that they were prepared for his exit, so that they could properly prepare to approach him and to take him into custody without further incident. During the conversations with other negotiators, he made several promises to come out, none of which he honored. He made several demands, which we actually did honor, including a request by him that he be able to speak with his wife prior to coming out. We honored that request, which I can tell you is outside the scope of normal negotiating practices for several reasons, one of the primary ones being that if somebody is intent on harming themselves, a lot of times they want an audience and someone close to them, someone they love. We weren't completely concerned or completely aware of what type of relationship he had with Mrs. Cady, but after speaking to her myself, I was somewhat assured that they had a good relationship and that him speaking to her might be a benefit, and he promised that after speaking to her, he would come out. He was allowed to speak with her for a period of time. They had a conversation. It was a monitored conversation, of course, but they had a conversation. At the conclusion of that conversation, Mr. Cady once again failed to honor the promise that he made to come out of the residence and resolve the situation. Every time we attempted to get Mr. Cady to come out of the house, we explained to him what he needed to do and how he would be approached and how everything would be handled and what would happen after that point, and that he had rights and that he could contact his attorney and anybody else he deemed necessary to contact to help him through this situation. We made that clear to him on several different occasions. He made several promises to come out, which he failed to do. After the negotiation stopped by his hand, after he stopped taking our calls and stopped calling us back, we spent several hours over the next several days. We monitored constantly any type of intel we could get from inside the house, including the coughing, including hearing a drill being operated, including several different things. And we reported that information to the tactical teams so that they'd have the proper information they needed to prepare themselves and to address any threat or problems that Mr. Cady presented and to possibly tactically plan his safe extraction from the residence and taking him into custody as ordered to do so by the warrant issued by a county judge. At no time during that time was Mr. Cady lied to. He was given complete 100% accurate information with regards to what was going to occur when he came out and if he came out. There was never any threats made to him. He was given the opportunity on several occasions to peacefully resolve this situation. All he had to do was agree to come out, which he did several times, but failed to comply and carry through with his promises. And they were promises by his words that he would come out if certain things happened. I won't get into all of them, but there were many times when demands were met without getting anything in return. And if you've all watched television or movies with regards to negotiations or hostage situations, it's a give-and-take type of situation most of the time. We did a lot of giving and got nothing in return from Mr. Cady. And at the end of this situation, unfortunately, Mr. Cady chose to end his own life, despite the best efforts of a large culmination of law enforcement experience on the scene. The last thing I will mention is that the SINT team is comprised of multiple agencies throughout the county, including our own Thomas County Mental Health Department, which has two trained negotiators on their staff. They're members of mental health that have been through police negotiation training put on by the FBI, not necessarily to negotiate, but to understand what it is that we do to try to convince somebody to come out. Conversely, many members of the SINT team have been through mental health training on how to recognize mental health crises, including situational crises and chronic mental health issues, so that we understand where the mental health aspect of this comes from. Because most often, when somebody finds themselves in a situation like this, they're having at least a situational mental health crisis. And with that, I'll end the SINT portion of the presentation.
As committee chair, I'm going to make the decision to extend the presentation, but also include legislator questions until 6:15, and still allow for the public Q&A from 6:15 to 6:45. It just means that we'll have very little time to act on the resolutions regarding juvenile justice reform and also the resolution against solitary confinement. So I just want everybody to be aware of that time frame. I am trying to accommodate that, getting as much information as possible on the table.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I'll just fly through a lot of this other stuff. Just to point out, there's a section here for scene documentation and evidence processing. Anytime you have a major case involving an agency, in this case it was the Sheriff's Department's incident, we were in command, we would not and did not do any of the scene processing or evidence collection. That's done by a different agency, and most times it is done by the State Police Forensic Investigative Unit, which was done this time. Autopsy findings, I know folks are interested in that. We still have not received a final autopsy report. Have no idea where it's at. The only thing I do know, that also goes to the State Police Forensic and Investigative Unit. And every one of those folks, just for information, every one of those folks is at the Harris trial out of town because they were involved in that. So it may very well be done by Dr. Terzian's office, but the report hasn't been put together. And to be honest, I have no idea what the status of that is. It will be added into the investigative report when it's done, when we receive it. There's some sections in here that document the weather conditions. There were some questions that we are aware of as to officials that were notified of this incident as it occurred. As has been stated, the district attorney's office was notified very early on. She actually responded, was made aware of the situation, was there actually 2 days in a row providing advice and just she was there. The mayor was notified. He never came to the scene, but protocol is when you have significant staff and resources being used, you have to notify your boss. We all have bosses. Lee Shirtliff from Emergency Management was there. He did provide some assistance. The Danby Fire Chief opened up the fire station for us. The highway superintendent, he actually unlocked the diesel fuel tanks for the highway department so that the armored personnel carriers could go down and refuel. The unfortunate part is that that driveway is so close to the Cady residence that access to the Danby Town Hall was not allowed. It was very much in range of the weaponry that we knew of. There was one snow event, and my understanding is that it was taken care of by neighboring towns, the snow removal for the town of Danby. There's another section on logistics. I won't go into too much of that. You can certainly read up on that, and I encourage you to do so. Media relations, there is a section in here about this. There were questions that we'd been receiving right along. You know, how much does this cost? We've got that in there as well. I do want to spend a little bit of time. I know we have just a little bit of time on what we learned and what the best practices are. A lot of the tactical leaders that were there were also present for a, I'm sure you've heard it a lot, an incident up in Herkimer. There's information on that in here. There's also, frankly, more information on an incident in Oneida County where a deputy was killed in a barricaded subject incident. They had an independent review of that incident, and the website for that review is in this document, so you're certainly welcome to go and look at it. Interestingly, they were provided with a list of 18 things that they should do so that that sort of tragedy doesn't happen again. We're not going to go through it, but the local SWAT team has the equipment or does 17 of the 18 and did so during the incident at Hornbrook Road. The only one we don't is we do not have, neither department has an armored personnel carrier. But we can certainly get one if we need one. Lessons learned and concluding thoughts. Specific areas for improvement, and this is all part of our our review. What can we do better? Civilian involvement, public information, communication with the public, and engagement of human service agencies. You're certainly welcome to read it. I'm just scanning it real quickly. Part of what happened is, we could have done a better job in terms of communicating, especially with the neighborhood. I wish we had time to read all through this, but obviously the town of Danby highway supervisor was aware of what's going on, but the town supervisor, we neglected to get a hold of him. There's other examples that could exist. What do you want us to go through this, or
you can be asked to leave?
Under Sheriff, why don't you just continue? Yeah, please. We're going to have a time for Q&A.
Media relations, we did issue press releases. In the future, we may actually use public information officers to do that sort of stuff for us so that we can concentrate more on the incident at hand. Using county resources, using county departments quicker, more efficiently, to let a lot of the ancillary stuff be done by folks other than law enforcement. They're certainly capable of doing it, and it would give us more time to do that. There's a section in here, you know, the sheriff should have been directly involved in the incident earlier in the process. He was called. A message was left. That's not the proper way to do things. If at the end of the day, if he's not answering, we'll send somebody to his house and go do it. Use of the Rook, which is a piece of equipment. There was a lot of discussion as to whether to use that or not. The decision was made to use it. A lot of explanation is in here that we're not going to be able to go through, but at any point, that is kind of a tool in the toolbox.
Do we have a picture of the Rook in your presentation?
No.
Okay.
No.
So
you can
visualize.
Google Rook and it comes up.
Yeah. So it's basically a big piece of machinery with sort of like a bulldozer capabilities with armor.
Go ahead.
So what it is it's a Bobcat, standard Bobcat you would see, and then it's essentially up armored, so it will protect up to 50 caliber protection, which in this case we would be covered as it was a 30-30 rifle, and then it has several attachments, one a shield, one a claw, and a couple other features that you can switch on and off the front, similar to a Bobcat for a farm, as you could switch the attachments for the job.
Can you, just for sake of clarity here, so you use this device when someone's barricaded in a building, and as an alternative to just sending people in, you use this Rook to tear down walls to eliminate the cover that they have and expose them? Is that?
The use of the Rook is kind of a last resort, if you will. Like I said, our team locally has worked over 30 barricades since our existence, and we've never used that tool before. So I wouldn't say it's fair to say that's just standard practice, if you will. But again, this was an unusual barricade for us, and I think if you look nationally, just based on the time frame. But yeah, the point is that before we're going to put an officer in danger, we'll break some walls down to see inside. It's property over human life, and that's the decision that was made. Unfortunately, it came to that, but I'm good
thank you, thank
over
you.
The potential of somebody being shot.
Yeah. All right.
Some of this we've already gone through. Establish a secondary command site. That's where your media relations, your community relations, that sort of thing. We had a spot. They opened up the fire station for us. But, again, our concentration was on the scene. The commanders were at the scene. There's actually an initiative that was in its early stages for a lot of this stuff, headed by or a group was gotten together by the county administrator, Joe Mariana, and it was unfortunate that its work wasn't quite completed. Maybe I'll give him just a couple of minutes to explain that.
I've got 10 minutes before we run out of time. Should I take all 10?
Well, that also has to be.
Brian's already explained
questions.
It. It is a protocol. So it's a notification. So if there is ever an event like this again in the future, a law enforcement event, there will be a reach out, a notification to the district attorney and to me. And from that point, others will be notified who may have an involvement in this. And it could be our human service people who might be able to provide some assistance. It could be other folks like the public information officer. So there is now a protocol in place that if anything, a situation arises, there is widespread notification. And among my jobs as county administrator will be to notify the chief elected official of the jurisdiction in which the event is occurring. So I know that the Danby Town supervisor has been concerned about this. So in the future, it is addressed by protocol in terms of alerting local elected officials as well as county elected officials. And the protocol is in the – we can provide that to you also so you can see that.
Okay. In terms of a summary or a conclusion, there certainly is one in the report. It just simply states, we do, as a matter of course, our own reviews of major incidences, major cases. That was done. It was done within a week of the incident with SWAT and SINT people, our folks at the sheriff's office, other agencies that were involved. And the whole idea is to, see what was done, what can be done better, how this fits with best practices and so forth. You can certainly read this. Where are we?
Can you read aloud these 3 points? I think this is important to understand.
These 3 points?
Yes, yeah. Because we have people that are watching via webcast, so it's important for us to mention this.
Lethal options were available throughout this event, and they were not. I can tell you that if someone fires at you out of a window, you are perfectly justified to fire back at them. That did not happen. The use of the Rook was based on the desire to avoid violence, injury, and death seen recently in Herkimer and Oneida. It's clear that the officers were at risk of injury or death.
And actually, there were pictures that are associated with this presentation that are not in the narrative, and I was wondering if we'd actually see those. And I believe that these pictures were taken by the state police, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, and also, Under Sheriff, it's standard protocol that when an incident like this happens, that since the state police, they're the ones that collect the evidence, they go into the scene before you guys do in the sheriff's office or the IPD?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So these pictures were taken by them?
Yes.
Can you just walk us through these pictures? Because I think it's important for us to understand the threat to the officers' lives that you had described.
Sure. Can you go back one, Joe? That's the stairway leading up to the upstairs. Tactically, just inside the front door? Okay. Tactically, that is not a place where you want to be. That is in the business called a fatal funnel. Anytime you're in a hallway, a stairway, something like that, obviously there's nowhere to go. That same railing that you saw in the previous photo, there's a loaded gun right there. The one on the right is the one you just saw. The one on the left is another one. Now, you'll also, okay, we'll do them all together. You see the blanket that's sitting there. Up at the top, well, you see there were a lot of beer cans just out of view here, along with cigarette butts. You'll see in the middle of the middle photo, that's a juice can or juice plastic bottle. It's half full of urine. This is exactly the situation that we wanted to avoid. I think it's obvious from those of us that are in this business and look at this that Mr. Cady spent significant time there to the point where he didn't even want to leave there to go to the bathroom. You can certainly draw a conclusion that he's waiting for someone to come in. He already invited us in. He said, I'm armed up, come get me. And if somebody is going up those stairs, they are in an extremely vulnerable position. And it was our intent and what we did all along was to avoid going in that house for that exact reason.
That's another gun that was downstairs. Another weapon that was downstairs. That's believed to be the weapon that he killed himself with. Same thing. Oh, right over where it says gun 5 and 6. It's actually inside a wall. There's paneling. You see where it's kind of peeled off there. Paneling, and there were two guns in there. I have no idea. Maybe originally there were all 6 in there. You need to remember Mr. Carey was a convicted felon. You're really not supposed to possess guns. I'm just guessing. I have no reason. You know, not a lot of people keep their guns inside a wall, but at any rate, that was there. This is the boys' room. This is the second floor room where the shot was. If the small picture to the left, the window to over, you can just barely see part of it, is over to the right. That's the window that he shot out of. The other photo, there are 2 shell casings. They are ejected to the right of the gun. One of the shell casings is spent or has been fired. The other one is not. But they're both in the position that would be ejected from a gun facing out the window. This is all collected. It's all documented by state police. We're not even in there. So I don't know if there's any more photos, Joe. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. That helps us understand that point. Can you go back to that summary slide, Joe? Right. I think that's good. Are you concluded, Under Sheriff?
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly read it. Yeah. We have other conclusions in here, right. You know, and we're not above scrutiny mm-hmm. at all. You know, we've given as much detail as we can in this report, and you know.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, I mean,
please,
you know,
read it.
I'm sorry, I know you put a lot of work into this. This is 34 pages, and unfortunately we couldn't read it, you know, word for word. And I know, just, you know, for the public's sake, that the undersheriff also provided this binder of his backup materials that follow along with the narrative. So I understand there's been a lot of work, and I'm sorry we haven't had the time to really dive as deep as we would like on this. I'm going to allow at least until 6:20 just some questions from legislators before we open it up to the public. And again, I'm going to stick to having 30 minutes of Q&A. All right. Yes, Martha.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, all the officers here and all the officers not that were involved. And this is obviously a difficult situation. And at least the fact that only one life was lost is commendable. I read the whole book over the weekend, and I thank you for giving us as much information as you have. I'm really quite impressed. I wanted to ask a couple quick questions. You mentioned that the throw phone was sent in, and was that so that is able to then, you're able to pick up sounds inside the house. Was that, like, from what time period was that available and working?
There was a significant delay in deploying the throw phone, especially during our process of communicating with Mr. Cady. The cell phone communications were going well. The throw phone is typically used in situations where other forms of communication are not available. So while we were using the cell phone that we spoke with him on, we didn't deploy that right away. And we actually, when cell phone communications started to become a problem, We told him that we wanted to send a phone into him, and he adamantly denied our request. He didn't want another phone in there. He didn't want us throwing anything through a window or a door or anything. He said he'd throw it back out. I can't remember exact words, but he definitely didn't want any part of it. It was after a significant period after communications stopped with him that we put it in there. And the actual capabilities of the phone, we don't really want to discuss, but let's leave it to say that it is a another form of communication that he never utilized.
Okay. Is it something where you could have, if he had, when he shot himself, was the phone in the house? Was it working? Would you have heard the shot?
We had two phones in the house toward the latter stages of this incident, and several robots. And among all of the equipment that was deployed in there, the ability to listen in to things that were going on was there. However, the placement of the devices would have affected our ability to hear any gunshot. Outside activities, some of these listening devices are very intense, and outside activities such as equipment in the area, the armored personnel carriers, loud hailing communications that we were doing from loudspeakers trying to get him to pick up some of those phones would have drowned out that particular event.
Okay, and very quickly, I understand Ms. Katie was involved at some point in, she spoke to him at least once. Were there other opportunities when she was, you know, involved in the negotiations?
She was involved to the extent that she had one opportunity to speak with him over the phone in our presence. I know there were several opportunities or several times when she was at the residence she was waiting on later on in the incident that he was able to communicate with a phone at that house and was communicating, I believe, with her and with other people at the residence. That typically is something we try to curtail because that clouds the issue and it limits our ability to communicate effectively and try to resolve the issue. But through some technical problems with the cell phone provider, we weren't able to direct block the access for him to call out and for only us to be able to call in, not at least right away.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. I have Carol and then Jim, and please be succinct because we are running low on time.
Okay. I have much less of an interest in going into the details of this incident than I do in the portions of this that are, you know, what? How do we move forward and ensure that we have a framework for a legislative role, you know, to fill up our promise that there'll be oversight and transparency and that we find a way to rebuild public trust and ensure a culture on both sides where we trust each other. So I hope that we can do that moving forward, and I like the part of the report where you talk about how to start doing that. I'll point to the example that we've used in some of our other departments. You know, the highway department a few years ago started out with some communication issues and things, just ways in which we thought as a legislature that we could be doing a better job or asking our department to do a better job. And so Joe was involved, Marshall Lynch was involved in just creating a framework. At what points, under what conditions, at what level of activity that we're going to engage in, do you communicate with the public and how? And that's something that it might be worth looking back at, so I'll just suggest that we go back to those notes. And then in terms of a question, you refer, we said on page 31, you refer to such a framework, you know, as of this writing, the framework for the responses to these critical incidents. Such a framework has been completed, and you refer to it. So is there a way to get a copy of it is really the main question that I have. Thank
all right.
You. It's the protocol I talked about.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to share that if the committee wants to talk about that.
would be happy to have that conversation.
I would not mind having that discussion at the next public safety meeting. We can accommodate that. All right, Jim.
Thank you, Nathan. Very quick. December 30, 2014, the narrative began. 9:22, at that point, the people on scene were notified that Ms. Katie and her children were out of the house. How did that happen?
I think that's part of my narrative, and that was essentially the on-scene supervisor from the sheriff's office talking with me saying the kids and the wife are out, so it's only him.
I mean, how did that actually happen? Did someone...
I believe it was a phone call. There was radio communication right. going on and phone call, and, you know, so I'm not sure.
Are you asking how they actually got out?
Yeah, right.
I believe they came out of their own volition. I believe they came out the door by themselves. I wasn't actually – I arrived right after that happened, so I wasn't actually there to see it, but I believe Miss Katie brought her children and came out of the house after several requests by Sergeant Van, who was at the scene.
Yeah, nobody went in and got them, that's for certain. They came out on their own.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So at this point, we will open it up to Q&A. I'm sorry, what? Oh, Dooley, you had a question?
Yes, I wonder which cell phone company was uncooperative. But my main question is about the notification of the sheriff. There's nothing indicating the time, who tried to reach him. I think that this could be expanded. Or is that information in an appendix, which I have not seen?
The information was in there. It was retired under Sheriff Osborne. He chose to try to contact me via cell phone, and as everybody in this room that has a cell phone knows, they don't always work in every location that you might be. He was fully aware of that. He chose to leave a message, and there were other means that are capable to contact me, and everyone was aware of that. I have a landline, as many people don't, but I do for that reason. And also, my location not that far from where the incident actually took place. But it was, you know, I had no control over that. It was the choosing of the person that made the initial phone call.
Okay.
Jim,
Will?
Will had his hand up.
Yes, that's why I said Will. Will?
Thank you, Nate. You referenced the use of robots to go in and essentially monitor the situation from inside. And did we hear there were five multiple different units from different sources? And is it true that they all failed? They all failed to actually do the job. Is that accurate?
To some level, yeah, they all failed. I mean, some were more successful than others. One of the big issues was, at least for, I know for our robot, our own robot, and as well the state police have the exact same one. Two issues. One was getting up those stairs. Unfortunately, they go up a lot of stairs, but there's certain types they don't go up. And you can see from the pictures, it was polished wood, traveled wood stairs, so they kind of have that slickness to them, and the rise was pretty steep. Our robot got about halfway up four or five times and came tumbling down, and eventually was disabled near the bottom of the stairs. So that was our issue. As far as the state police's robots, they brought in some bomb robots that also ran into hiccups, and I can't speak to what those hiccups were exactly, but I mean, there was several $100,000 worth of equipment that essentially didn't get us where we needed to be, which was the entire residence, and that's unfortunately one of the downsides of technology, that it's awesome and it looks really great and it works good in training, and then sometimes in the real world it just doesn't do what you think it's going to do. But at least we tried it, and, you know, we kind of know some of the limitations now, and we can work towards more success through our training in the future.
Okay.
All right. I really cannot allow any more legislator questions because I want the public to be able to address the sheriff. So I'm sorry about that, committee members. Obviously, we can find another time, maybe next committee meeting, where you'll be able to do that. All right. So with this next portion, we have just under half an hour, and I want to make sure that everybody has a chance to speak. But that ability of you all being able to speak is very much depending on the people that also speak. I've had you fill out these blue sheets here, and if everybody spent 3 minutes, we would go 33 minutes long, which was, and that doesn't even include the response from the sheriff or undersheriff. So I highly advise And I'm still going to give you your 3 minutes, but I highly advise that you try to make your statement very quickly, or if you have a question, just get straight to the question so that we can have appropriate time for an answer. I will not allow back and forth communications. Please ask your question and then get the answer. If there's a point of clarification, not an additional question, then I will allow it, but if I find it is not a point of clarification, then I will move on to the next speaker to be respectful to them. Okay? So with that, I would like to invite up Supervisor Rick Dietrich. And by the way, please state your name and also the town and or city in which you live.
Hello. Thank you, Nate. Thank you. Rick Dietrich, Town of Danby Supervisor. I think I agree with Carol in terms of healing and establishing a new degree of trust. I will say it again. I said it when I was up here at this mic some time ago, that I think an independent review, especially as it concerns the list of questions that the residents of the town of Danby have submitted that I don't think have been adequately addressed, would be warranted, and I'm still asking for that. There are other people here that will have different questions, perhaps, in terms of some of the things that were said. So that's what I'm asking for. I still would like that independent investigation. I do not think that the questions that the town of Danby has submitted were adequately addressed, and perhaps they could be with an independent crew. My question is, I'd like to know why the mayor of the city of Ithaca was on scene, and I'd like to know what his responsibilities were, and why, for some reason, that was important or more important than the town supervisor.
He was not on scene, as we mentioned in this report, Mr. Dietrich. And as was mentioned in this report, he also was there because of protocols when the SWAT team from the city of Ithaca is called out. Since he is a governing agency boss, he is notified that that agency has been dispatched to a location outside of the city of Ithaca or within the city of Ithaca limits.
My information, he was on the scene and that he had some authorization to implement some of the proceedings.
He may have, if he was, I never saw him at the scene, but I wasn't there 24/7. If he was at the scene, he probably just came up as to be a supportive boss. Stopped by to see how things were going, checked in with the chief, that kind of thing. He often does that on other situations. I can't speak for sure as to whether or not he was there because I wasn't there for the entirety of this incident, but I know when he's notified because there is a use of a large amount of city resources, and it's our chief's responsibility to notify him by rule.
I understand, but my position, I mean, here I'm the chief elected officer of the town, and I find out there's another chief elected officer in my town making decisions.
He wasn't making decisions with regards to anything going on in your town. The decisions that were made at that scene were made by police officials. He was there just as a support role to stop, and if he stopped in at all, as with other incidents, he comes to just offer his support to indicate that he's there and that he can be reached out to by the chief or the chief's designee if there's anything needed that he needs to authorize the provision of.
All right, well, we can actually verify whether or not he was on the scene. It's not hard. I will contact him, and we will find out. All right?
So, again...
But I understand the point, Supervisor Dietrich.
I do not think my town was adequately taken into account. Yeah. I don't think the residents on Hornbrook were looked after. I don't think that their health and safety was taken into consideration. I don't think the town operations were considered. I do think that we could have done a better job of this from my particular point of view, but I'm going to relinquish the floor, let other people ask their questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Legislator Dennis, would you have?
Very quickly, I noted in the slideshow, that Chief of Staff Kevin Sutherland made an appearance there for a very short period of time.
All right. So let's move on to our next speaker. I have Sophie Zapala. And then after Sophie Zapala, we have Tom Sini. All right.
My name is Sophie Zapala. My name is Sophie Zapala, and I'm a resident of town of Ithaca. I am deeply concerned about the use of excessive force and military-style action by the police early this year that resulted in the death of the Tompkins County resident and victim, David Cady. I am also very troubled by the lack of both the transparency and willingness on the part of the Department of Justice to validate our community's concerns and refusal to investigate conduct of the various law enforcement agencies during this crisis. We cannot and will not normalize using the military and disproportionate tactics against civilians in this community. We must ensure that compassion and patience are applied when dealing with people under immense emotional pressure. We must insist that all possible means have been exhausted before any violent methods are used. We must restore humanity in us and the police community relationships. During the January meeting of the Public Safety Committee and the sanitized and selective debriefing, many disturbing statements were made, but one, repeated several times, especially caught my attention. The goal of the police from the beginning to the very end was the same, to get Mr. Cady out of the house. They never changed their goal, and everything they did between December 30th and January 2nd were to serve that goal. But was that the right thing to do? No, it was not, and he paid for it with his life. The police, once informed by his wife and other blood relatives that Mr. Cady was suicidal, should have switched from the apprehension arrest mode to saving his life. That possibly could have been done by giving him some space, by backing away from the house, allowing him more time to calm down, and establishing ongoing and caring communications with his mother, wife, relatives, kids, attorney, or a local and independent from the SWAT team mental health professional who could send him some medication. Our law enforcement's priority should have been to prevent the victim from killing himself rather than attempting to get him out of the house, something he obviously dreaded the most. Instead, the police kept assaulting the house by means of robots, probing devices, dozens of tear gas canisters, poison gas, and finally the infamous rook. All of those actions did nothing else but push the desperate and frightened man to the breaking point. He must have been terrorized after days and nights of such attacks. If only the people in charge acted with some compassion and did not itch to use the heavy equipment they hauled from afar and the weather was warmer. If only. Sheriff Lansing strongly objected to discussing what-if scenarios or alternative ways to this crisis could have been handled. That is very telling and unacceptable. This is precisely what we have to do. Investigate what happened, who made the decision, and when the lapses in good judgment took place. Next, the alternative approaches need to be identified and written into any protocols that will be used in the future so that another tragic and unnecessary violation of the resident like this never occurs in our county.
Thank you.
I also signed up to speak, but I'll give my time to her.
Okay, well, that's fine. I'll allow it.
Another reflection of mine is this. Thank you.
But just please keep in mind that you are taking the time away from other speakers.
No, but that is...
I know, but there are other speakers that would like to speak and ask questions, and we have a very limited amount of time. All right, so just that's all. So please continue.
Another reflection of mine is this. I do not think the events would escalate in the same fashion if the subject were a well-established local professor or businessman residing in a million-dollar mansion in Cayuga Heights. My intention tells me he/she would be given more leniency, time, and patience in negotiations. Finally, it appears that state law enforcement agencies had a hand in the most aggressive tactics against Mr. Cady. We must find out how those people supposedly experienced in handling similar incidents got their experience and training. I would not be surprised if the trail led us to Israel, where so many of our law enforcement officers receive their training these days. Tompkin County should make it a policy to disallow our officers from learning in Israel or here in the United States from those who became experts in oppression of Palestinian civilians. We're using excessive brutal force, killing, beatings, torture, police-assisted home demolitions, and kidnapping of children at night are a norm and have been for decades. We must resist the militarization of, and dehumanization of our police in Tompkins County for our own sake and for the sake of justice for Mr. Katie. Finally, at some point in my life, I volunteered for a hotline similar to the Suicide Prevention and Crisis Services Organization here in Ithaca and was required to take a training to get the certification called Suicide Prevention Assist. In my opinion, all military-style action police took against Mr. Katie were counterproductive and only increased the chances of suicide. Should the residents of Tompkins County who are in crisis and who perhaps are suicidal fear that our law enforcement will use the same anti-terrorist tactics against them, we should be very concerned about that possibility, as well as we should be concerned that out of fear, those who need our help will not make the calls to the crisis line. An independent investigation into the standing critical incident protocols is a must. We must make sure we all, and especially those who are in the state of mental distress, are treated humanely. Thank you.
Thank you, Sophie. By the way, I got word from the mayor that he was not at the scene. However, he was in communication with Chief Barber several times. All right. I have Tom Sini, and then after Tom, I have Janet Steiner.
I agree with the previous speaker's comments that this seems to be a little bit overreacting to the situation. I don't see why we couldn't have just waited him out. There's no reason, it seemed to me, that other than one shot being fired, that a house without power, without heat, and a man without food was going to hold up there for very long. So I'm upset about that. Did anybody hear the shot Wednesday morning that Mrs. Katie heard?
How do we know that?
Mrs. Katie heard a shot from where she
was. I can tell you that we deployed several, as I noted, noise flash devices, which produced 174 decibels.
What do you have?
Definitely sound like a gunfire as well. Later on in the incident, when we deployed gas, they also deployed out of guns and they're fired with.
All right, hold on.
When did it happen? At 5 o'clock in the morning? Wednesday morning. Yeah.
Yes, there was several, as you can note in the report in the timeline, there was noise flash devices deployed in those hours in the morning. So that's absolutely possible that you could have heard those. They're very loud, and you can hear them from several miles away, especially in an open area like that.
And did Mr. Katie's gun make an equal noise to that, the one that he supposedly took his life with?
I didn't hear his gun go off.
But, I mean, in general, that kind of a gun, I don't know.
Would not.
No? So it's logical that that gunshot would not have been heard?
It's highly possible that a gunshot inside a house wouldn't be heard. That's correct.
Well, okay. I'm amazed at that. With all the listening devices you had employed there, robots and... I don't know.
Okay. All right. Next. Thank you, Tom. I next have Janet Steiner. And after Janet Steiner, I have Frances Helmstetter.
This is Janet Steiner from the town of Danby. When I read the report and also the newspaper reports, it was really hard for me to understand who was in charge. There seemed to be a rotating number of undersheriffs, city police, I now understand what happened to the sheriff, which is that he didn't know what was going on until almost, right. So if you had known at the say within an hour when other SWAT teams, you would have been there, and would you have stayed on the scene and you would have been in charge at all times?
Please use your microphone.
I'm a little bit older than some people, but I was there at least 16, 18 hours a day once I knew. We also have to rotate our abilities to get some sleep also. So the undersheriffs, that's what they are about, second in command. They can be first in command when the sheriff is out of town or not available. Unfortunately, I wasn't available because I didn't get the message. But.
And did you feel that when you found out what was going on, that the train had left the station, had gone down a route that you might not have gone down?
No, ma'am, not at all. I trust impeccably the people that were on the scene. They're highly trained. I know their reputation and other incidents we've had. I have the utmost confidence in everybody was there from the agencies involved.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Just a point of clarification. By protocol, you are supposed to have an incident commander at all times, correct? And was there an incident commander at all times?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Next, I have Francis Helmstetter. And then after Francis, I have Sherry Cortheis.
Is it possible for me to cede my time to Joanna Cipolla-Dennis?
Well,
I'm already signed up. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, okay. All
right. My name is Fran Helmstetter. I live on the Danby Road in the town of Ithaca. I'm 80 years old, and I feel a great deal less secure and more vulnerable knowing that this kind of military-level resource is available to the police agencies in our community and our neighborhood. I think that the community has to be kept in mind here. This community, myself included, have been traumatized. This is a tragic event, not only for the Cady family, but for the community, for those of us who have looked upon the police as agents of safety and comfort in our community. This is a shocking event using kinds of equipment that I think in this case, you know, we're just outrageously overdone. So I would just hope that an evaluation would be done of the community, the impact on the community with reference to the procedures that are adopted. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I have Sherry Cortheis, and then after Sherry Cortheis, I have Melissa Cady.
Hello. I'm Sherry
Cortheis. And please state your municipality, too.
Say what now? Oh, Sherry Cortheis, Ithaca. I haven't spoken on this yet. It's the first time I've had a chance to. I did speak out against the jail expansion. I've spoken out against all the military equipment that we've accepted from the Department of Homeland Security at the city level, at the Common Council, and also at the legislature level, where we just accepted a ton of spy equipment, $200,000 worth. What I don't like hearing tonight is that you guys are justifying what happened somehow with this report, trying to say that what happened was okay when it wasn't. This militarization of the police has to stop at some point. I mean, I don't know what it takes, how many signatures we need to collect from the community, but to return this equipment to the Department of Homeland Security, it has no place in the hands of police officers who are trying to protect citizens and citizens that you work for us. And you guys, and then you keep quoting this Herkimer, New York problem. And, I mean, this guy was on a rampage killing people. He wasn't locked up in his home suicidal, and this man was suicidal. He needed mental health, not noise and guns and people, and he didn't want to go to jail. And there's a reason he didn't want to go to jail, because you're isolated from your family members, because you can't make phone calls, because you only get two visits a week, Tuesdays and Saturdays, and you only get one visit on those days. And so he probably didn't want to go back to jail. He's scared that he'd already spent, from what I understand, the report a couple debt times. And I just don't know. I just think that the militarization, everything that everybody has said is right. It does have to stop. And please listen to the citizens and think with your conscience and your heart and empathy and compassion more often, because we're about, with climate change, I keep bringing this up, it's going to be a situation where we're going to want to take care of each other. And this that's going on right now isn't working. So, anyways, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Sherry. I have Melissa Cady, and then after Melissa Cady, I have Bonnie Dawson.
Hi. Long story short, I had a bunch of questions, but I kind of ran out of them. First of all, I had a house phone in my house.
you all know I have a house phone. You've talked to him on my house phone. Second of all, I don't care what you say about your lovely little deploying things. I was a mile and a half away. I know the difference between a gunshot and the cute little flashbangs because I heard him on the phone when I was on the phone with him. The last conversation all of you had with him is a lie. I was the last person to talk to him, and you know it, because your investigator was sitting with me. Jody Combs, where is he? He was in this from the beginning to the end, but never has sat here and had to say a word about what happened up to my house. Wrong or right? I'm right. With the guy who knocked on my door. Did you state what he said to me when he came to my door? No. He said to me how he's going to take my children from me. That was his words to me. Not no sweet, where's Dave Cady? That's why it all started in the first place. I came to you personally and told you he was suicidal. I came to Jody. I came to the guy who decided to treat me like crap. I came to all of you. I told you, don't use me and my children against him. You did. The reason why he shot outside was because you wouldn't tell him where the hell I was. Heck, I was. Sorry. I mean, if you're going to tell the report, tell it the way it was. I was there. I mean, I'm not saying that you guys are all completely wrong in what happened, but for the most part, you are. Like, the guns you showed pictures of, most of them didn't even have bullets in my house. And you know that because you have it in evidence. I mean, don't put it all on him. I'm not saying that he should not have turned himself in, because of course he should have. But it isn't all him what happened up there. It was boys with toys. You destroyed a home. I mean, literally destroyed it. I mean, my tub is down the freaking field. I mean, my dryer was clear over. I mean, really? You destroyed my home. I mean, just destroyed it. And I lost my husband in the midst of it. And all you had to do was try to help him. That's it. And you, I don't even remember seeing you there. I remember Jody. I remember you. I mean, I wasn't there while you were there. I mean, most of the people who are talking, you don't even know what you're talking about because you weren't there. Not when I was there.
I was there. I didn't see you, but I was in the next pod over.
Please use your microphone.
Regardless, my point is...
I was there. I was in the next pod over from her.
My point is, yeah, they sat here and told you this lovely little story about how everything went up there and how Herkimer County has something to do with it, which it doesn't, because my husband was never, never violent. And him going to jail and these little bits of things, most of that's wrong, too. I mean, yeah, he was sitting on, a second DUI going for a third one, but spending lengths of time in Tompkins County or whatever county you named that I've never heard of, no. He spent a few days here and there in Tompkins County. Regardless, that's what I had to say.
Thank you. Just for a point of clarification, who is Jody Combs?
He is our senior investigator for the Tompkins County Investigative Unit.
Thank you very much. All right.
Miss, if you want my
okay.
Minutes.
All right. So I have Vonnie Dawson next, and then after Vonnie, I have Ed Kalkenberg.
Miss is a lot easier. I'm Bonnie Dawson from Groton, New York, and Miss is a lot easier on you guys than I am. The sheriff was called, and he didn't answer. He says he didn't have service, but David Cady wanted to talk to the sheriff. He requested to talk to the sheriff, and somebody should have drove out and got the sheriff or called the sheriff's home phone and got the sheriff. You've got somebody suicidal and he wants to talk to somebody. Somebody ought to be getting at somebody on the phone so that somebody can talk to him. When they have a request like that and they're suicidal, you should get them on the phone or get them out there to talk to them. He probably wanted to talk to him about going to jail to see if he could help him. He probably didn't like the conditions of the jail, the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches every night. Maybe bologna would have suited him better and he would have went. It's not funny. Why is it so funny to you?
It would be nice if you would speak the truth, okay?
It's not funny. Peanut butter and jelly is what my daughter was eating over there.
All right.
You think it's funny. It's not funny.
I like the truth to be stated, okay?
Okay, what do you feed them?
Please calm down. Please calm down.
This is not a debate.
What do you feed them over there?
What do we feed them?
Yeah.
You name it, we feed it to
them. Really?
Okay, Vonnie, do you have a question that might be more pertinent?
I just ask him what he feeds him at jail. There must be a reason why David Cady didn't want to go to jail. I hear all kinds of complaints coming out of that jail.
All right.
I don't think any of this is funny.
I don't either, and I don't consider your questions very...
And when I sat here and watched the undersheriff Cancer still way he speaks, rocking in his chair, moving his feet all over the place. Okay, we've got one person here that really speaks the truth and another person there that reads pretty well. This person right here, I believe he speaks the truth. This one here, he can't sit still in his chair. He's all over the place. You don't even want to talk. Why? You're the sheriff. How are you going to do in front of a jury when she puts you in front of a jury like she's going to do? I hope she does it. I honestly hope she does it because she's lost everything. And I hope her landlord does it, too.
All right, next I have Ed Kochenberg. And then from there, Ed, after Ed, we have Joanne Cipolla-Dennis.
And, hi, my name is Ed.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, Nate.
And I just wanted to say that we are running, we have about 10 minutes left, and I do really want to pass these resolutions on solitary confinement and juvenile justice reform. So please try to be concise, and if you have a question, ask that question specifically and to the person that you want them to answer.
Thank you, Nate. My name is Edward Kochenberg. I'm a resident of the town of Danby, and incidentally, I'm a fire commissioner in Danby. When I, just as a preliminary comment, when I keep talking to the chief about what happened on that day, things essentially are the same as Rick Dietrich said. They got a call to have the station ready, and they couldn't get any communication out of people on a regular basis as to what was going down. And they did keep the station open, however, and they weren't sure. And they had the ambulance standing by, too, which is not, I don't think, mentioned in the report. But perhaps it's in the backup material. An overall comment, I think it's fine that you're holding these meetings, but I think the time that the public wants to essentially grill people is co-opted or preempted by these longish reports that are just essentially read to us. And as I made as a Soto voice, although it wasn't too Soto voice, comment, most of the people in the county can read, and you have a fairly long report here. That doesn't mean they'll read it. I agree. One question I have is there's a lot of things in here that say this is kind of standard protocol, and they may well be, but do we have... Or do you have, or can you describe incidents where this rook had been used recently, anywhere, in Pennsylvania, in New York State, and so forth? And it may be in the documentation that backs this up, but if you could share some of that with us. Well, I'll give you one other question, and then I'll sit down, and then you can go from there. So there's things in here that bug me because I'm a quantitative kind of guy. And so when you say we threw in tear gas grenades or whatever they are, tear gas canisters, and fired those in, my question is how many, what is the typical response from one, two, three, five? Every time I talk to people who have subjected themselves voluntarily or involuntarily to tear gas, they say it only takes one or two in a closed space. And I understand the idea about the drop ceilings, but that isn't the first drop ceiling in the county. And so I would like quantitative stuff. And, again, that may be in all the backup things. But I heard rumors of 150 tear gas canisters fired, not all of which went off because some of them were, I guess, provided by that were out of date. But that kind of thing would be nice in there. And so I'll leave you with the two questions, the rook and the tear gas.
Okay, so first, thank you for the fire hall. That was beneficial for us to use the facilities there, so thank you guys for that. Secondly, the rook. We don't own one, obviously, within the county, and it's not something that is used locally very frequently. However, I can tell you that the last time it was used in Pennsylvania, I don't know for certain. I know they used it on the hunt for the subject who shot the state trooper in the head outside the barracks. They used it on that. I don't know in what capacity. And they've told us that they've used it several times throughout the years. They actually own two of them. So on top of that, though, I wouldn't be able to really tell you too much more on their use, but they are experts in its use, and that's why they were the ones that were actually using the piece of machinery, not us. We don't have the training to operate it. Secondly, as far as the CS gas goes, I've been exposed to it several times. We get exposed to it yearly. It's a less lethal option. Like you said, it's not comfortable. As far as it goes, you're generically speaking correct. In theory, a few cans in a confined space and you would be coughing pretty good. But there's a number of factors that could work against you in that, one being the drop ceilings, two, access to a ventilation pipe such as a dryer vent or something to get fresh air from, a gas mask, which we didn't find any here, but just giving you examples of different things that can work against you. As far as the number, there was a large number used, but you got to remember that that's over the course of a long period of time. And you're talking about trying to work systematically through a structure that was over 2,000 square feet, which is a lot of square feet, especially when you have open windows. So those, the number of canisters is really, it seems like a lot. You know, you say, 100 and something canisters, and that would be a lot if it were all at one time. But try to remember that was over the course of a couple different days, and as well throughout the house, basement, all the way up to attic, and the 2,000 square feet does not include the full basement or the full attic. So just try to take that into consideration when you throw those numbers out there.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Also, just to answer one part of your statement, Ed, I do want to take responsibility for the format tonight. I thought after seeing all the questions from community members that it would be better if we did a presentation first, because I thought many of the questions would be answered. I did not know how long it would take to read through that, and I understand how it got perceived there, and I take full responsibility. It was my idea to do that, and that's why I really want to make sure we get all these questions answered right now. But I'm sorry about that format. I did not have any ill intentions with that. That was a fault of my own. Yes, Carol.
Perhaps you could poll committee members and staff as to whether we could stay a little bit later.
I will allow the next three questions, which are all the ones I have, to go through, and I will make the decision to take the time to consider those resolutions, considering how important they are. That's fine. Yeah. All right. So next I have Joanne Cipolla-Dennis, and then after Joanne I have Jamie Hendricks.
Thank you for hearing me. I'm from the town of Dryden. The first thing I'd like to say is this was not enough time. We need another meeting for only the public, please. I would like to know where Chief Barber is and where the two officers who went originally are. They should be present. Secondly, I'm going to yield the rest of my time to Melissa Cady. If there's any time left, I will come back. Thank you.
I just want to say that you can go in my house right now, like today. I can take all of you there, and you can't breathe. Okay, that's how much tear gas is still in that house as of right now. So for him to say that over a course of how many ever days that you needed that much tear gas is wrong, period. You can go there today, right now, and have tear gas on you. So you're wrong.
I don't want to get in an argument with you. However, after the scene was done by the state police, I personally walked through the residence without a gas mask, and there was a little bit of odor, but you were able to walk through it.
I personally walked.
There was a large number of canisters used, but like I said, I gave this gentleman the explanation for that. And unfortunately, we didn't have the results that we hoped for.
Thank you.
I personally walked through that house myself when you guys left, okay? And when I walked out, I had a Tyvek suit on and a respirator on my face. I took them both off and climbed into my vehicle. By the time I made it a mile and a half down the road, I stripped naked in my friend's driveway and ran into the bathroom because I couldn't breathe. I had snot running down my nose. My tears were, so you're wrong. Sorry, because I witnessed it myself. I went in it. And like I said, go in it now because it's still there. And secondly, the Rook, let me tell you about the Rook. It has five cameras on the front of it. One is an IRA camera, which means they can see it extends over like 9 feet. Once it extends, they can see 365 degrees with one pole. There's a camera on the back. Inside, there's six screens. They all hook together. It all can be hooked to your command center. It's all recordable. The robots they put in my house, all recordable. Where is it?
That's incorrect. Our robot, at least, does not have a capability to record.
What about the Rook?
I'm not sure about
that. I'm sure. I called the company myself. Right. I called the company of the maker of tear gas. I know that tear gas was banned in 1980-something to be used against military, so you can't take it over to, like, China and use it on them, but you can use that on us. Right or wrong?
CS gas is something that's used, yeah. Like
but
I
not,
said, I'm exposed to it yearly.
But not used in military.
I have no idea. I'm not in the military, ma'am.
Nor do you know if the
gun in my house could have shot through what the equipment either, right?
Joanne, did you want to?
Yes, thank you.
I'll add about 30 seconds of time for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. The first thing I'd like to say is, as a former corrections officer who was disabled in the line of duty, to hear that police officers are now not willing to risk their life to save somebody's life because they might get hurt is disgusting to me. I don't want that kind of police officer. I want competent police officers. I'm staring at one who is not competent. And I'm not the first one to ask you to resign, Sheriff Lansing. You have held this community hostage for at least the last year because you have hired police officers who you know are overly aggressive, have complaints against them, and you have received complaints from the public in writing to dismiss those officers, and you refuse. So I am not surprised at what has occurred.
Thank you, Joanne.
I am very disappointed in you, Mr. Robertson. I really am. I hope you do better. The investigator, Mr. Young, is that your name?
No, Mike Gray.
Mike Gray. I really appreciate the work that you do. I hope that it doesn't work out like it did in this case on your next case. And I believe that if officers who went to the house originally had acted in a professional manner instead of swearing and threatening David Cady's family, you would have been successful. And I'm sorry that they did not do their duty, that they were entrusted to protect and serve in this community, and they fail at that miserably, and they will continue until they were removed. Please remove them, Tompkins County community. Come in here and continue to request that Sheriff Lansing be removed by Governor Cuomo and that Barber come in here and face the music.
Thank you, Joanne.
Where is the mayor of Tompkins County? Where is the mayor of the city of Ithaca who ordered this and approved it?
Thank you, Joanne.
You're disgraceful. Please do better.
All right. I have two final speakers. I have Jamie Hendricks, and then after Jamie, I have Bill Coons.
Hi, I'm Jamie Hendricks from Trumansburg, and I was out of the country for 5 weeks, so I have not followed everything. But my first question is, since you have a detailed timeline starting at 7:55 December 30th, do you also have a detailed timeline of who the incident commander is, like starting at 7:50 December 30th, like who carried the final responsibility until the last minute?
She wants to know if you have documented when incident commanders were on and off.
And their names.
And their names.
Like, who was the first commander of the scene? Because Sheriff Lansing wasn't there. So who was the first person responsible for everything? And then when he went away, or, like, how did that, was it one person, or were it multiple people that kind of gave authority from one person to the next in terms of overall responsibility for all the decisions being made?
Overall responsibility, the first night, then Under Sheriff Osborne was there. I was there shortly afterwards.
So it's first Sheriff Osborne, and then you took over.
Well, we were actually both there.
Okay.
For the first night.
Yeah.
Sheriff Lansing showed up at 6 o'clock the next morning. And basically how it went from there is he goes home, or we go home, come at night, he goes home, you know, he's switching back and forth.
So the two under sheriffs and the sheriff, you shared kind of final responsibility for everything that happened.
Yep.
Okay, and then the first question, another question, maybe slightly more trivial, but it's December 30th, it's the day before New Year's Eve, and you would think that everyone is kind of celebrating something. So why did you choose that day? Why not just wait till January the 3rd to kind of go and, I mean, like just inconvenience someone at his house and kind of destroy the whole festive atmosphere. So who made a decision that it needed to happen December the 30th?
To go to this man's house,
yeah, and serve the warrant. Why not give the man an opportunity to be with his family?
I mean, that's a deputy's. There's a box that has warrants in them, and they have to be served.
And there is some discretion.
And this warrant, the attempts to serve this warrant were numerous.
12, I believe.
12, yeah. There were actually.
Failed 12 times.
All right. Okay, please. Let's stick. To,
12 times.
All right. I have, and then now I have the next question. I have Bill Kuhn.
How you doing? My name is Bill Coons. I'm a resident of Danby. This is just funny how some of the stuff comes out. Like, you guys can hear him walking around the house, cough and hack, and we can't hear a rifle shot. Like, I've been hunting. I'm sure you can hear him a couple miles away. Like, I'm sure the guns are probably within 15 feet. I serve in Fort Benning, Georgia. I've been in the gas houses myself. Like, usually you're only in there for 5 to 10 minutes at a time. Like, if you had that many rounds, which I picked them up, there's 80 of them. I have 80. And there's probably still some stuff in the house. So if you were stuck in a space like that, because he didn't leave, he was stuck there, you'd be crawling out your skin. I don't know if you believe me or not, but that's the way it is. Do you know the warning label on the CS gas? You should. You're a SWAT guy. You use them, correct? You use them in training, I'm sure. Yes, no?
Yeah, I just spoke a little bit ago. I'm exposed yearly.
Yeah, what's the warning label on them say?
I wouldn't be able to read you.
You don't memorize? Like, that's what I'm kind of baffled about, too. Like, you should be, like, on top of your game. You're the head of SWAT. You don't even know what some kind of gun sound like. Like, you think you'd be on top of you would know what you're talking about a little better. The warning label says on a CS gas canister is be curious, do not shoot directly, could cause hazard or death. Okay. Second thing it says it has a shelf life of 5 years. And then it says if it is expired, do not use after 5 years. And it says do not use.
Yeah, and I can speak to that a little bit. That sounds generically correct, as I wouldn't be able to state it verbatim. So the expiration dates, what that essentially means is the effectiveness of the gas. So after that expiration, they can't guarantee that the gas is going to be at the specs that it was when you ordered it. That's why they tell you don't use it. I know we use some cans that were expired, and they may not have had little to any effectiveness, but it was what we had as a resource.
I understand what you're saying there. But you know what it explains to me? That it sounds like you can't even bring a can to use. So how the hell can you follow protocol? That's the way it looks like to me. You know?
You give me a can, okay. I'm quite certain I can read it.
All right. Well, here. I got it right here on my phone. I'll show you a picture of it.
All right. Well, you know, I don't really want this back and forth.
Not an inquisition.
Right. Yeah, it's fine.
I have the warning label right here.
So what this warning label is telling you here is that you do not direct fire these rounds, meaning, as I explained on the first meeting in front of the legislature, is they need to be shot in an upward direction into the ceilings. We talked about the ceiling tile issue. And that's what that warning is right there, because if you fire one at somebody, there's a high probability if it hit them directly, it could kill them. And then again, number two, the shelf life. Again, as I spoke about, is just they can't guarantee the effectiveness of the gas.
You're willing to kill them.
All right, we do. All right. All right. Thank you. I'm just going to, since this is really our time to speak, I'm going to do two things. I'm just going to allow, if anyone has not spoken yet and would like to speak, you can still do so. And then also I'm going to open it up just back to legislators, because I know there's a couple questions that have come out of this Q&A. That's okay. But I'm going to accommodate both requests, because I believe this is our time to do this. All right? Yes. Can you please... After you speak, fill out a form so we can have that on a record, but still state your name and also your municipality. All right. That's fine. And if you could form a line if you were interested in speaking, that would be fine. Thank you.
Hey, thank you for asking for other people. And thank you for the detailed report. The thing I don't
I'm sorry, your name and your municipality.
Oh, I'm sorry, Nancy Metzger. I'm from Danby. I live up the road from the incident. One thing I didn't see in your report, I wonder if you could address, is did you hear the gunshot that Mr. Cady, when he killed himself? You were there with listening devices. I don't see that addressed in the report. And if you did hear it, what time did you hear it? And if you didn't hear it, I wondered if you had any idea when you think he killed himself.
I'll start, and then if you want to add
you.
On. I wish that we had heard it. Certainly, it would have given us a little bit more intel. If we had heard it, we certainly would have told you about it at this point. At least from my review of it, and again, we don't know for certain when it happened. We estimate, but I believe it happened on the final evening when the state police was on scene. And I can't guarantee that they had somebody listening to the devices, the listening device the whole time. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I'm not going to speak to that, right, because I wasn't there and I'm not part of the state police. But it's highly likely with the machinery working right on the house there, right where he was found, that certainly could have muffled the sound. If you've ever been around any piece of machinery, you can walk down the commons for certain, and you know it's very loud. You can't even hear yourself think when a piece of machinery is running. It's certainly possible that it occurred during that time. That's as much as I can give you. I mean, I wish that we had heard it and that we could say, yeah, we heard it, and we would have been able to move forward differently had we known exactly when it happened.
Thank you.
With regards to the listening devices, as I stated earlier, they are very good. However, they're not perfect. There may have been some transition time where we're transitioning out personnel. Many of my people were on the scene for multiple hours, but when they were transitioned out, there may have been times when they weren't being listened to every single second. We tried to monitor them as often as we possibly could, There may have been times when we were swapping people out that didn't happen. Also, as I previously mentioned, some equipment and other resources being operated outside the house could have muffled our ability to hear that happen. Gunshots, if you have any experience with any weaponry at all, the sound of a gunshot can be muffled by a lot of different factors, including the environment, including the area you're in, if it's pressed closely up to a person, that can muffle the sound of it. There's a lot of different factors that could have come into play here for as to why it wasn't heard. And if I can just take 15 seconds to address another issue, there was a comment earlier with regards to suicide prevention training. I can tell you every member of the Tompkins County negotiating team that's attached to this incident has been trained by suicide prevention and suicide prevention methods and techniques. Some of us at a very, very high level, several days and hours of training beyond what your typical suicide prevention worker gets. So if that gives anybody any perspective, last comment I'll make. With regards to officers willing to lay their life on the line for people, absolutely. If people are in danger and we can go in and help them and prevent them from facing that danger, we absolutely will. When it comes to running into a situation where the person has put themselves in danger and has indicated their willingness to jeopardize the lives of the law enforcement officers there to try to protect and help them, then we're not going to rush into a situation where we're going to actually be accused of committing suicide ourselves, because we're running into a situation that's not winnable.
Yeah.
And with regards to the delay or why we didn't delay executing the warrant, there were several delays created by Mr. Cady by not heeding to the requests of law enforcement in coming to answer these. Every time that warrant was attempted to serve, when there was contact with someone, there was an advisement that he contact the sheriff's department or contact a police agency to turn himself in. And lastly, with regards to that, had we not continually attempted to serve this warrant and Mr. Cady had gone out and decided to drink and drive, he was arrested 3 times in less than a 10-year period. Who knows how many times he did it without getting caught. Had he decided to go out and drink and drive one last time and ran into and killed a family of four, what kind of questions would you have for us then? And that's the last thing I'll say.
Thank you. All right. And so I have just 2 people from the public that want to speak, and then after that we're going to just open it up to legislators. And so I'll have the gentleman over in the back here, and then, ma'am, you next. And please state your name and your municipality in which you live.
Good afternoon. Chairman, thank you for convening everyone. My name is Michael Vincent, first name Crea, C-R-E-A. I've pastored One World Life Systems, a human rights ministry pro bono for the last 25 years. The first point of order is my condolences to Mrs. Cady, her entire family. It's unspeakable. I had to be here because I could not imagine the accounts that I was hearing and reading. I can't believe, I can't even imagine the trauma and the terror that you've been put through and also had a loss of your home as well. Not to mention the scarring of every single New Year for the rest of their lives. That said, I've had the EDP people, emotionally disturbed persons, call the police. I worked for Trinity Church on Wall Street. We had an ex-incarcerated man who was convicted of murder. We were in one of the drop-in centers, 2 floors below a government building, normally like this, having movies and whatnot. And he got very agitated. But you do not escalate. You do not escalate. There was no reason, if a warrant had not been complied with for 12 times, to do it during the 12 days of Christmas and then go home and celebrate New Year's and celebrate your own family and yet leave another family devastated. What was done, frankly, was morally bankrupt. You might have followed even every procedure correctly, though on words of the former speakers, I would have to not agree. What I ask, there's homonyms. My first stop and search was at the rifle of a British soldier when I was 13, holding my 4-year-old sister, my mother holding my 2-year-old sister. We're reverting back to fornication under the command of the king. That's what F-U-C-K means. Legal, regal rape. Legal, regal rape of the Cady family's rights. Another homonym for SWAT, and I would like the county jurisdiction representatives to consider, that for whatever money we're taking for this militarization of our police, probably 1/10 could be another use of SWAT, social workers addressing trauma. We need to have a human rights court. We need to bring in people that do atrocious things. In the same time, we can bring in a landlord in 15 days' time, a bad tenant in 15 days' time. Why not an absentee sheriff? Why not a force that is using excessive force irrationally more than the person they say they need to comprehend? Thank you.
All right, and our last public comment.
My name is Diane Olden, and I live in the town of Danby. So I have, I just want to voice the bit of frustration that I have at the process, because I feel like part of what's been happening or part of the frustration is the lack of ability for the public to really have time. So I appreciate you extending the time, and it still feels a little out of balance to me. So what I heard about the use of the rook was in Pennsylvania, it was decided to be used for a person who shot a cop in the head. So it just, again, I want to echo what's already been said of the response seems way out of proportion to the situation. And I understand a shot was fired and therefore everything from that point on felt justified. My comment to that is I would like to see pictures of what the house looks like now as part of the report, because there, what she said, I saw the house. I have to drive by that house. So I'm sorry for your loss. So it just feels, again, seeing the funnel of doom or whatever you want to call it, I respect that. I understand that. But what happened at the house and what she is describing isn't in there, and that's part of the issue. So I want to echo Rick Dietrich's question and comment and request of an independent investigation and not this, not more of this, but an actual investigation into what happened. And I'm also, a comment that was made earlier, you could hear him breathing. You could hear a drill being used. So I don't understand why a gunshot was not heard when you can hear the level of breathing. So, again, that seems out of proportion to what. I'm just curious now. I'm a little what's up?
I think that was previously explained by investigator.
The there's word of a dog. There was word of a dog being seen. I'd like to know, and is the dog okay?
The dog was freed Wednesday afternoon at 1 o'clock by one of the robots. When he opened the door, he was immediately taken to the SPCA and taken care of. As far as the constant idea of noise and what you can and can't hear, everybody here is an educated person and understand. There are certain times that there was noise, as has been stated many times by other people, that you're not going to hear certain things when noise is there. That's just common sense, okay? We're not trying to hide anything. We have given you a 34-page report that everybody's a little bored with, I guess, but we didn't want to leave anything out, all right? And we haven't. We have nothing to hide. And if you want an independent investigation, that'll be up to the people that sit here, all right, not us, and that'll be somebody else's decision, not ours.
Okay, and so no, we are done with our comments for now. We are done with our comments.
Just a point of clarification.
We are not able to. I'm sorry, but we really need to finish the.
Just a point of clarification.
We have to go over what we need to go over for the committee.
So you're not willing a point of clarification, like
what is your point of clarification, Joanne?
He said that we deployed these instruments so we could hear, and then he said, well, we may not have been listening at that time, or we may not have been listening at that time, or we may not have been listening then. Why don't you listen for the duration intently so you can hear a man who is probably likely going to commit suicide blow
your point is taken, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Now, so I need to move on now. Do any legislators have any questions so that we can address the actual? There is still one person that has a question. I gave the opportunity for people to raise their hands and say that they wanted to speak. All right. Well, and I also asked people to line up as well. So please ask your question, but then we immediately have to move on. And I don't know if we're going to be able to get to these resolutions now that we need to in order for state action to be taken. So this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't have a question. I just want to say that this was way overboard. I know Missy, and I know her two boys. I didn't have the pleasure of knowing David, but I hear he was a good guy. She's without a husband. Those two boys are without a father. Somebody should have suited up and went in there and helped him. His shot was a cry for help. And nobody helped him. And he's dead. Who?
All right.
Who wants to trust the police when you do this? And Sheriff Lansing, you do need to retire.
Yeah.
Maybe you should go racing with the Reynolds. Maybe that's.
All right. Thank you very much. Now, legislators, are there any questions? Yes, Martha.
spotlights on them.
Oh, I'm sorry, ma'am. What was your name and your municipality? So that we can add... would you be able to sign a blue form so we can add you to the public record? Thank you very much. All right, Martha.
I want to say I think, you know, we live in a unique community. I'm glad we are in a place where citizens feel that they are empowered and take the time to hold public officials accountable. I think it's also incumbent upon all of us to listen to each other. I'm afraid that hasn't happened today. My grandson, who was 5 at the time, and my son were smashed into while they were on a sidewalk about 5 years ago by a drunk driver. My grandson almost died. He was in the ICU for weeks. 2 legs and 1 arm were broken. His collarbone, his head was fractured wide open. He has scars in numerous places still by a drunk driver. I want to thank these officers and all the others who are part of keeping us safe and trying desperately to keep the people who are so irresponsible as to drive while impaired off the roads.
Then you don't want
and I want to, it is my turn. These are the people who put their lives on the line every day and every night. And it's not a job I want to do, and I'm thrilled that other people do. I want to just say, if there's a question in here, if there was a rifle shot on Wednesday morning, why in the world would all these officers stick around when they might have thought that the incident was over and they could all go home? It doesn't make any sense. They obviously did not hear anything that indicated the incident was over on Wednesday or Thursday until they saw Mr. Cady's body on Friday morning. So whether something was heard or not, the point was certainly no reason this cadre of officers wanted to stick around in 10-degree weather for 2 more days. How many gas canisters, whether they were out of compliance, the point was they didn't work. The point was they wanted to get him out of the house, and he didn't leave the house. So this was part of an effort to end this without any shots being fired, and none of these things worked. It didn't work for our officers' lack of trying. It worked because Mr. Cady had made a decision. Now, let's remember he had pled guilty to felony DWI. He had gone through our drug court and decided he was not going to stay with the drug court. He'd gone through every option our community offers.
Let me tell you something about your drug court program. You need to review that thing, okay? Because it's bullcrap. And for you to sit there and justify it is ridiculous. Pure ridiculous.
Let me tell you
your drug court program. You're not making it work.
Hold on.
They're the ones who told my husband.
I've been to the sheriff's department at Christmas parties. I've seen him drive drunk.
All right.
I want to say I think that most of this community respects our law enforcement officers, and I'm really I appreciate
please.
What you've
look
done.
I'm sorry.
News. Look at people
Bonnie,
are taking
please.
Care of people themselves.
Bonnie,
nobody
you've had
wants
a chance
to
speak. You've had a chance to speak.
Do the resolutions tomorrow night.
Yeah. You want to do the rest? Yeah, that's fine.
Because of people.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Bonnie. All right. I just had one more question from the legislator. Is that right? Carol?
Okay. So I have a question about what the process will be, not just by us, by the other branches of government moving forward. The democratic process specifically says that we need a separation of powers because our democracy is best implemented and served when we have a separation of sort of the executive, administrative, enforcement powers, the legislative powers, and the judicial powers, the enforcement end, the administrative end, specifically don't write their own rules because it's best to have a separation, people thinking about what the rules ought to be from those who implement them. The legislative branch concentrates on what those rules and policies ought to be, which is our role, and the judicial role is specifically to hear separately and more objectively and judge whether the rules have been written correctly and then implemented.
Right, and we can certainly have that discussion.
So I'd like to know what the process is for us, for the judicial, for the, where did these things sit?
Well, I can't speak to the judicial side, but as the chair of the committee, we as committee members, you have the power to continue this discussion, and so we can do that. All right, Will?
I guess I'm arguing for defining what our role is, what our authority is.
Why don't we talk about it at the next meeting? It's awfully
not
late.
Now. Yeah. No, not now, but Will. For people to understand that that's what our role is and that there are other avenues.
Thank you, Nate. And I guess I want to share my frustration at this meeting, which Nate, I know you've done a very good job to try to move us through, but it's fundamentally we're trying to cover a lot of material, trying to understand it, and I didn't begin to ask the questions that occurred to me as I was reading this report. I would second the call that I would like pictures for the on the condition of the house that was left, because I've seen the video that some citizens posted, but I think that ought to be part of the story. I have to really, really take exception with what several speakers told tonight, challenging the bravery of our law enforcement people. I mean, the truth, as Martha said, is every single night that they are out or day, they are putting their lives online. You never know when something can go awry. And seriously, folks, we depend on them to keep order and safety for the entire community. And sometimes things go horribly, horribly worse than anybody would have wanted. What I'm looking for in this whole process is not looking backwards to condemn what happened, but looking forward to see how such an incident might be handled better in the future. The mother and children were got out. Yes. No law enforcement people were hurt, but also one man died. And would there have been ways that we could acted differently that would have changed that outcome? And yes, we did a severe destruction to the home that was shared by this family. I want this to continue, I guess I really, really hope this will not be the end of our examination of this.
Thank you, Will. All right, I'm going to conclude the meeting just with some final comments. First, I want to apologize to the people that are here regarding the solitary confinement and juvenile justice reform resolutions. I know you spent 2.5 hours here waiting for that. I'm sorry we have not had a chance to get to it, but we are well over our time.
I'm ready to do it just right.
Yeah. If there, all right, are you
I'll
willing
move the
to?
Solitary justice. Yes, I'll move that one.
All right. Well, I have a resolution urging New York State Assembly and Senate to pass the Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Solitary Confinement Act. And that's moved by Martha and seconded by Will. Any discussion? All right. Carol?
Do we know anything about whether there are competing bills?
No, I don't know. This is why I wanted to not to take it. Yes?
Carrie has some – Carrie could probably shed some – light on that.
All right, that's fine, yes. And actually, as Carrie's coming up, I just wanted to thank the Sheriff's Office for presenting today. And I wanted to let people know, too, that this was the work that the undersheriff and the sheriff did, they didn't have to do it. There was already a public meeting about this at a public safety committee meeting, but they chose to do this report, spend dozens and dozens and dozens, actually hundreds of hours, putting together this report. And if you look in the narrative, which I highly advise that you do, the 34 pages, not only did they respond to the community's request for a timeline and detailed events of what happened, but they also looked at what happened in other areas and lessons learned from those other counties, and they incorporated that into this document. They also, as Will is addressing, put in information about how we could prevent something like this from happening in the future and lessons learned. So I really think that they went above and beyond, and obviously there's a lot of questions, but I want to thank the sheriff and the undersheriff for being transparent and open and be willing to have the questions from the public, even though it was difficult. And still, you know, maintain your composure and be able to answer those questions the best you could. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Carrie, did you want to address the solitary confinement?
Yes. So in terms of competing bills, there is another bill. I think it's sponsored by McDonnell, and it addresses primarily just the minors that are in solitary. It's not nearly as comprehensive as this bill. There's also a lawsuit settlement that's still being hammered out that could have some effect on the use of solitary. As of now, the temporary settlement for the lawsuit is that pregnant women are not supposed to be put in solitary, and we hope that children aren't and developmentally disabled. So it's also more limited, and it's not final.
Martha?
I call the question.
Okay. All right. All those in favor?
I just got
the
question answered.
All right. Great. All right. You withdraw the call to question?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Carrie. Are there any other questions related to this? All right, all those in favor of the resolution, please raise your hands. And oppose, and that passes unanimously. Thank you very much. Next, we have a resolution urging New York State to fund probation departments and other impacted county departments. All right. And that's for the full cost associated with raising the age of criminal responsibility to 18 years of age. So moved by Jim and seconded by Martha. Any discussion on this? I know we had quite a bit of discussion last committee meeting about it, and I want to thank Joe and Pat for working on this resolution and addressing the concerns that were brought up by the committee. Carol?
Yeah, I'll vote for this, but I'll just request that it not necessarily be on the consent agenda.
Oh, yeah.
I have some concerns about whether our pushing for this can in any way be taken or used out of context by those who want to see such a bill defeated. This is the one raising the age of criminal responsibility to 18 years of age. I would really hate for our pushing to put the funding issue before the policy decision. I understand why we're doing it, but I'm really going to be upset if we get taken out of context and quoted as a county that...
Okay, thanks, Carol. Joe, do you want to address that
quickly? I'm confident it won't be. All we're saying in this resolution is we are holding the governor and the state legislature to its word, to their word. And their word is there will not be any local costs created by this initiative that we support and they support.
Okay, all those in favor, please raise your hand. And oppose, and that passes unanimously. I have one more action that needs to be taken, an appointment of Jason Leifer to the Board for Indigent Representation. And can I have someone move that? Moved by Carol, seconded by Martha. Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye. Or raise your hand, sorry. And oppose? All right. I want to thank everybody for attending the meeting today. And I want to thank everyone for also being patient through this process. So thank you very much, and have a good night.